Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. In August of 2017, President Donald Trump threatened to unleash fire and fury against the Democratic People's Republic of Korea and their leader, Kim Jong-un. It was a tense moment in U.S. relations with North Korea, and it led to threats against Guam and verbal assaults between the two leaders. Well, Americans often don't seem to understand much about the DPRK, largely because we see little from the nation except for propaganda, robust celebrations of the Kim regime, and a thirst for nuclear delivery capabilities that could reach the U.S. Benjamin Young is a professor of cyber leadership and intelligence at Dakota State University, and he's joining us today a little over 67 years since the July 27th Armistice Agreement about what he calls the massive psychological divide that looms over the 38th parallel. Dr. Young, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lori. I appreciate it.
You sent us some papers, and you have a book coming out in 2021, so we're going to give you an hour because we could talk when that book comes out so much about North Korea and our understanding of it. But I'm hoping in the interest of time today, we can focus on one incident that you highlighted in one of these papers and use it as a greater window into our understanding of the people of North Korea or the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. And this is in the 1976 axe murder. There's a tree growing in the DMZ. And tell us, for people who don't know that story, a little bit how it unfolds, and then we'll expand into what we can learn about what two sides think about each other using this incident as a lens. So describe to us a little bit what happened with a tree.
Yeah, so in the middle of the DMZ, which is the border that divides North and South Korea, there was a large poplar tree and was obstructing the view of the United Nations Security Command there. And they had asked the North Koreans very nicely if they could cut down the tree because it was obstructing their view. And this was all according to protocol. They were going by the rules. And North Koreans just said no. And so the United Nations then decided to send out a team of South Korean woodcutters accompanied with a few U.S. soldiers to go cut down the tree. The North Koreans angrily protested. They sent about 24 soldiers out, and they demanded that the woodcutter stop cutting down the tree. The woodcutters, with the help of the U.S. soldiers, said no. And so what then unfolded is that there was a melee between the North Korean soldiers and the South Korean woodcutters and the U.S. soldiers, and a couple of U.S. soldiers actually died in the incident. They were murdered with axes that were actually used by the North Koreans, because in the DMZ, you're not supposed to have firearms with you. So this is why that incident is infamously known as the axe murder incident. And also a few of the South Korean woodcutters were injured quite severely, and I believe a few were killed as well. So this incident is kind of little known in the grand scheme of U.S.-North Korea relations, but I think it's really quite important, because this was not a directive that actually came from the leadership in Pyongyang. What archival documents have told us now is that it was started actually by a North Korean military general. And I think this is important because it means that there's this kind of anti-Americanism psychological component is so deeply ingrained that sometimes soldiers and generals take it on their own accord to go after what they perceive as their immortal enemy, as they call the U.S.
What did Americans, and in connection, maybe, the ROK officers, like, what did we not understand about the emotional impact of that tree? Because it's about more than, going into the demilitarized zone. There's the North Korean soldiers feel like this tree is worth killing over.
Yeah, so the tree was supposedly planted by the leader of North Korea, Kim Il-sung. And in North Korea, they have almost a theocratic-like system in which they worship their leader like a god. And so to Westerners, this appears very odd and kind of outlandish. But to North Koreans, you have to see their system really in like a theocratic sense. And so if this was planted by their God, then there's no way it's going to be taken down by the, quote, evil American. So they guarded it as if it was, like, their life. And the U.S. didn't really realize the significance of that tree at the time and the emotional importance of it.
Yeah. You said evil Americans there. And I want to talk a little bit more about, I think a lot of people in America think of North Korea as kind of unhinged or crazy, or, you know, they have this regime that goes on and on. They see us as these, you know, the enemy, the forever enemy, the imperial wolves, the all these things. Talk a little bit about what is at stake if those two characterizations, you know, what's at stake for diplomacy? What's at stake for avoiding a nuclear attack between these two? Like, what is at stake with that misunderstanding of each other and that lack of fullness of understanding?
Yeah, it's interesting because you brought up that the U.S. sees North Korea as crazy and unhinged a lot of times. And I say that's ironic because North Korea actually sees the U.S. as crazy and unhinged a lot of times. And one of the things that the North Korean state-run media brings up a lot is they don't want what happened to Saddam Hussein in Iraq and what happened to Muammar Gaddafi in Libya to happen to them. They don't want their state to be basically full of anarchy and chaos. And so that's one of the reasons why they say that they have developed nuclear weapons, is because they want to preserve their system. And nuclear weapons enables them to basically compete on this great power stage with the U.S. And now that they have ICBMs that are capable of hitting the U.S. mainland, it is you have to treat North Korea differently than you did before. And it's because that they have nuclear weapons. I mean, to be quite honest, the only reason why we treat North Korea with such seriousness in the national security community is because they have nuclear weapons. Otherwise, it would just be kind of an odd state actor in the international arena. But because they have nuclear weapons, they are a threat.
Do the people of the DPRK want to preserve their system, or is the regime want to preserve their system? What do we know, even though we, you know, we can't walk down the street and, you know, put a microphone in front of, you know, a North Korean citizen and ask them, what do we know about their support of the system? Or are they an oppressed people that would rise up against that regime? Talk a little bit about that lens that sometimes we look at North Korea through.
Yeah, I actually get this question a lot from my students, and because you get this kind of depiction of North Koreans as just being like forced to do everything. But in North Korea, there's an information blockade, so they don't get access to the World Wide Web. They don't get access to a free press. And even within the country, there are travel blockades. So if you live in the provinces, you can't travel to the capital city, Pyongyang, without a permit from the government. And so what this environment creates is a lot of internal unity, because you just are kind of ignorant of the outside world and you're ignorant of the situation. And so what I like to compare it to is a fishbowl and a fish, that the fish only knows the fishbowl. It doesn't know the world outside of the fishbowl. And because the fishbowl gives it life, then that fish is able to survive. And so if you think of the North Korean system as the fishbowl and the North Korean people as the fish, it makes a lot more sense, because then it basically, they are synonymous. They have a relationship that is not at division with one another, but is actually quite unified. And the border with China in North Korea is actually quite porous. You could pay off a border guard with a bribe, and you could flee into China, but you don't see thousands and thousands of North Koreans leaving. And I think that actually raises the question that are North Koreans supportive of the regime? And I think they are, for the most part. I think a lot of propaganda might seem to us to be outlandish, but I would say probably North Koreans believe about 70% of it. Even North Korean defectors that move to South Korea, they have a really, really hard time believing that Kim Il-sung, the leader of North Korea, started the Korean War in 1950. They have a really hard time believing that narrative. And there's even some cases of North Koreans who defected to South Korea, then re-defecting back to North Korea because they did not like life in South Korea. So I think it's sometimes a Western mindset to believe that North Koreans hate the system and they're just waiting to rebel and there's a foot on their throat and they can't do anything against the system because they're so repressed. And I don't think that's the case. I think even if you're an authoritarian regime, you need to depend on the degree of popular support. And so this makes the situation quite a bit different from the Middle East, where Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi were actually quite unpopular amongst the people.
Dr. Benjamin Young from Dakota State University, professor of cyber leadership and intelligence at DSU, is a book coming out about North Korea in 2021, and we'd like to invite you back for a longer conversation about that once we have that in hand. Thank you so much for the conversation today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.